Thank you for joining us today. Our prayer is that your life will be touched by the Spirit of Almighty God with constant and powerful truths that can be applied to your everyday life.
We're doing kind of an overview, and we went over several things about evolution and the different ideas that go with it. And then we ended up on how to defend your position. And we looked at some rules of, you know, don't freak out when you're in a conversation with somebody. Don't get this excited. Well, you're just an idiot, because that's what the other side does. Anytime you can watch this all the time on news shows. Anytime somebody says a fact and the other person doesn't like the fact, they start insulting the person that just said the fact. You know, if you have no argument, insult the person that said something. That's the general rule of how to win a debate the illegal way. It's not really winning the debate. And we went through several pieces of evidence that they give for how they support macroevolution. And I don't know if I said it enough, but when you try and talk to an evolutionist about evolution, they will never use the words, as far as I know, they'll never use the words macroevolution and microevolution, because they don't want to split apart their idea. They want them to be together, because if one is true, the other must be true, and you're not gonna see. They're just not, well, what's that? They don't like getting specific in terms, except when they like getting specific in terms. It's kind of frustrating. But all that being said, I want to go right into Darwin and his ideas about his own theory. When he wrote his book, he gave four things that he thought were really pretty devastating to his own theory. And they were in chapter 6 of his book that he wrote from the very beginning. He said, if these four things could be proven true, then my theory really falls apart. So I want to look at those, because they're pretty interesting. So is everybody ready? All right, here we go. He said that natural selection acts solely by accumulating slight, successive, favorable variations. It can produce no great or sudden modifications. It can act only by short, slow steps, okay? Now, this idea has been gone over and gone through quite a few times, because as we've seen in the fossils, there are tons of places where there are major changes. It's not a slow, successive anything. So he said that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Okay? So, let's look at one here. Irreducible complexity. Now, this is a scientist named Michael Behe, and he came up with this idea called irreducible complexity. Irreducible, you can't make it any smaller. It has to be at least this complex to make any sense whatsoever. And he gave two good examples that we're going to look at here. The first one, obviously, is not a natural one. It's just one to help you understand the second one. The first one is a mouse trap. Okay? He said, the mouse trap and the bacterial flagellum. Did I say that right? Anybody know flagellum?
Yeah.
Okay, great. These two examples illustrate IC because they are composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of these parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. There is no purpose to it. Okay? Everybody got that a little bit? Let's go to an example. Everybody usually falls into one of two categories. They're either a concept person or an example person. You can learn by somebody telling you a straightforward fact, and just give me the fact, and I can absorb that concept. And then there are other people, you tell them the straight fact, the concept, and they're like, I don't know what you said. Could you give me an example? And you give them an example, so we'll try and do both today. The mouse trap. Everybody's seen a mouse trap. Everybody's used a mouse trap. If you take away any one of those parts from that mouse trap, the mouse trap stops working. If you took away the spring, there's no point to the mouse trap. If you take away the slapper there, it's not going to, it can trigger all at once, but it's not going to trigger anything to happen. If you take away, say, the wooden base, the whole thing is just going to sit there in a lump. Every one of those parts has to be there. If you take away the cheese or some kind of bait, there's no draw to the mousetrap, and maybe something randomly will happen. But its whole function and purpose here needs to have all the parts for it to work. Okay? Now, this makes sense. Obviously, that's manufactured. That's not something that you find in nature. But this is. This is a close-up of a bacterial flagellum. This is something that's like a propeller on the end of a bacteria, okay? And this propeller, when you look at it, has all of these different parts in here. You have the U-joint, and you have the actual propeller on the end, and this part spins around like this. And then you have what looks like a rotor and C-ring here. All of these parts, this membrane, all of this is put together, and if you take away any one of those parts, the whole point of the thing is it doesn't help whatsoever. Now, that's for moving bacteria around. If you take away any one of those pieces, it doesn't work. Well, how does this relate to what we just said? If you only developed, if you were a bacteria and you developed this part alone right here, what good is that part? And why would you pass that on to anything else afterwards? Does that make sense? If you had the propeller on the end, but you had no motor to make it run, do we see what I'm saying here? You got to have all of it happening at the same time. And you'll see this over and over in just about every example in nature, people have lots of ideas. The evolutionists will come up with lots of ideas of how, well, this could happen and this could happen and this could happen. And that's great, except that we don't see that anywhere in nature right now. And lots of things had to develop simultaneously in the same organism and then be passed on with something else that had the same. Does that make sense? So we're going to see this over and over again. Every cell in your body's made up of about 7 trillion cells, something like that. Every single one of them has a problem with Darwin's theory. Every single one. Each one of your cells are made up of what is called membrane proteins, okay? Every cell in your body. These brain proteins are both the building material and the builders of the cell. This is very key. This building here is not a cell. If it was a cell, the wood would have built itself. Does that make sense? The things that it's constructed of would have had to construct it itself. Proteins don't know what to do without instructions from deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. They don't have plans for what to do. They don't know what to do. Proteins don't do anything without help from DNA telling it what to do. DNA is the thing that stores all information of life. And everybody knows what DNA is now. Thank you, Jurassic Park. It never got bigger than when you had that little guy swimming around on the thing and saying, I'm DNA. You know, maybe that just stuck out in my mind because I was 8, but DNA, everybody can say DNA and think that they're awesome. Nobody before that wasn't in the field was like, yeah, DNA, that stuff. It stores the information for all of life. But DNA serves only as schematics and doesn't actually do any work itself. It's just blueprints. It would just be the blueprints for this building. The blueprints can't do anything to help construct this building. DNA is built by proteins. Are we starting to see the problem develop here? Proteins can't build themselves or anything else without DNA, but DNA can't exist without a protein building one. And in fact, DNA can't even communicate with proteins without RNA. It gets worse and worse. RNA is like the messenger between the two. But RNA doesn't do anything but relay messengers. It's just the messenger boy. And they've tried to theorize what came about first, and they've said RNA, they've said DNA. It's really a lot trickier than which came first, the chicken or the egg. Which we know the answer to that one, right? Which one came first? The chicken. Why? Because God made the chicken. Okay. Or some variation of the chicken. But a chicken on its own will survive, and an egg could possibly on its own survive and do something on its own. Both of them could serve some kind of function, even if it's just an edible egg. Which came first, the protein or DNA? Neither one serves any function or purpose without the other. They have to have come together simultaneously.
What were the chances of life arising on its own?
It's been speculated that probably there would have to be a minimum of about 250 proteins to provide minimal life function. If that's really true, then I think it's almost inconceivable that life could have happened in some simple step-by-step way.
Okay, so the simplest form of life requires at least 250 proteins to function. What's so difficult about that?
Welcome to the Casino of Life. Who wants to spin for a chance to win? Oh, sure. I'll give it a shot. What do I win?
Take a look at this.
Huh? How about the world's first single-cell organism? This perfectly aligned string of proteins could be yours.
Now, take a spin.
I won!
Tina, tell him how many times he needs to do that to win the prize.
250.
That's right, folks. And all in the correct order.
But that's impossible.
We've heard that before, haven't we, Richard?
Come on, Mother Nature. Do your thing.
Richard Dawkins.
You stupid machine. I hate you.
Their idea is that everything had to have come spontaneously and happened by chance. And the idea of proteins and DNA coming together at the same time, or 250 proteins coming together and being built and arranged perfectly, and all of that happening through some sort of slow process, it's ridiculous. And their answer to how do you account for a bunch of different things is, well, you just got to give it enough time, which is why they keep adding more and more time, because there's not enough time. Darwin's problems with his theory, straight out of chapter 6 here. His first problem is this: why, if species have descended from other species by insensibly fine gradations, do we not see everywhere innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion instead of the species being, as we see them, defined? This is a very, very good question. Why isn't everything in confusion? Why is everything separated out? Why don't we see everywhere things halfway in between? There should be some things that we see out there. There should be probably some kind of mix of like a lion zebra or something, or a gator bird. That'd be pretty, I wouldn't want to run into that in the park. the birdfish, there should be some kind of, okay, that could be pretty scary too. Never mind. The tiger owl. Something that might make hunting a whole lot more interesting. The lion-a-roo. Catrilla. A gorilla and a cat. I like that one. I don't like cats, though. There should be a lot of confusion everywhere. The reason these look silly, because they were put together to be funny. The reason they look silly, everything is separated. There's nothing that's really mixed in and blended together. Everything, you can really group everything. Well, that's that, and that's that, and that's that. And Darwin's first problem with the series is, why don't, when we look around at the earth and the animals and everything, why isn't everything in confusion? Why is it all separated out? Chuck, I think that's a good question. I mean, maybe we should revise the theory. Second problem. Is it possible that an animal having, for instance, the structure and habits of a bat could have been formed by the modification of some other animal with completely different habits? Okay, let's take something that is analogous, or is it homologous? I get the two mixed up. Let's take an example of one that at least looks like a bat, like a rat. Okay, bat and a rat look similar. But one's got wings, they're both rodents. Aren't they both in the rodent family? Anybody know? No? Nothing? They just look like it. If you have a bat that operates and lives and moves and breathes and does things in a certain way, how could it have come from something, some other animal that had completely other habits? How does a bat fly through the air? Anybody know? With his wings, but how does it see? Sorry. Sonar. It sends out a pulse, and it has it come back to it, and it can tell what's in front of it. It's pretty crazy. There was a very old movie. Anybody ever watched the Moody Science videos from like 50 or 60 years ago? Okay, these things are really awesome. They're incredible. There's 20 of them from like the 50s and 60s, and they're the most incredible, well put together science videos ever. In one of them, they take a bat, and they say, the whole purpose of the video is that whatever you find in whatever man has created, God had it first, and he put it into animals, and one of them was sonar, and they took a little bat, and they put blindfolds over this little bat, and they let it go and had it flying through a box that had bars that weren't wide enough for its wings to fit through, and it took off, and it flew right through them with having its eyes completely covered. It just took off and went right, twisted completely sideways right through the thing. Then they took the cover and they put it over where the sonar comes out, and it flew right into the bars. It could see the bars perfectly, but it just flew right into it. How does that come from an animal with entirely different habits? It's a really good question. Can we believe that natural selection could produce, on one hand, organs of trifling importance, such as the tail of a giraffe, which serves as a fly flapper, and on the other hand, organs of such wonderful structure as the eye, of which we hardly as yet fully understand the inimitable perfection? It's a good question. Maybe we should change the theory. Third problem, instincts. Can instincts be acquired and modified through natural selection? That's a good question. What shall we say to so marvelous an instinct as that which leads the bee to make cells which have practically anticipated the discoveries of profound mathematicians? Anything you know about anything about bee cells? The honeycomb. It's crazy. Okay, another Moody Science video, actually. Anybody know what shape they are? What shape each cell is? Huh? Six sides, a hexagon. It is the perfect, most efficient shape that you could possibly come up with. There are, if you had done circles next to each other, tubes, cylinders next to each other, a bee would have fit in really great, and he could have put all his stuff and got all his stuff out of there. But there'd be gaps and spaces in between it. No matter how you stacked it together, it wouldn't be efficient use of space. There's only three or four shapes which interlocked perfectly with no gaps, okay? Triangles, squares, and hexagons. I think those are the three. Triangle is great, but in the corners, if you were like this, the bee couldn't get up and make good use of the corners of the shape. Square would be all right too, it'd be better, but the perfect, most structurally sound, most efficient shape is the hexagon, which interlocks all the way through that. And in fact, we use that shape when we build planes, fighter jets. They put it in between here for lightweight structure. It's flat and put in between the two pallets, the two panels, to increase the structural integrity of the wings. The bee had all of that. How did that instinct get acquired over time? Does that make sense? It's crazy. It's almost like somebody put that in the bee in the first place. Fourth, how can we account for species when actually being crossed, being sterile, and producing sterile offspring? This, to me, is the nail in the coffin. When you cross a species, say a horse and a donkey, what do you get? A mule. And what's wrong with that mule? It's sterile. So when we force species to cross the border, they're no longer able to make any more species. Almost like there's this thing that's keeping them from doing what evolution is trying to say. These are really good questions that Darwin came up with, and I don't know of anybody that has answered them yet. If you have somebody that has come up with an answer for these, I'd love to hear it. I think that they pretty well dismantle his theory, because every one of them is still true. Science itself has problems with Darwin's theory. There are several things that we'll go through just quickly. The law of conservation of energy. Law of conservation of energy. And I know we're going back to science class, and you may or may not enjoy that, but law of conservation of energy says energy cannot be created or destroyed. Now, I do know of one exception to this rule, and that would be God, who creates, the Bible specifically says, creates something from nothing. But in the physical world, energy cannot be created or destroyed. But the theory of evolution states that in the beginning, nothing exploded. And then we have everything. And we're gaining energy without... And they have all kinds of ways to talk through this. They'll say, well, that's in a closed system or that's in an open system. It's all kinds of linguistics, again, to just say, well, at some point, this is a closed system. You guys even say there is an edge. At some point, law of conservation of energy doesn't work. Law of entropy, I love this one. Everybody know the law of entropy? In a system, the amount of disorder or entropy must increase, and the amount of useful energy must decrease. Everywhere and everything, you see this. The older I get, the amount of useful energy that I have, it keeps going down. I remember, because I look at my kid, and I'm like, I remember doing things like that, and I don't want to do anything like that anymore. You just went, and I'm like, I'm fine to sit here. I'm okay. I yell at entropy all the time for no apparent reason, because things just mess up all the time, and they've been messing up. Thank you, Grandpa Adam. I mean, when sin entered the world, everything started breaking down, and everything is getting less and less useful, and there's less and less energy. Everything is breaking down. That makes it really hard for us to move upward and progress forwards if there is a law of entropy. Another one, the law of biogenesis. We saw this one in the video last week. If you weren't here, he said at one point there was a rock, there was mud, and then there was a living organism. How did that happen? And he was like, well, one theory is that it piggybacked on the backs of crystals. And crystals mutated in something. And we're like, okay, but there was something living that came from something not living. How did that happen? When we have a law in science called the law of biogenesis, all life is from life. They went over this and over this and over this because they wanted to make it happen. Francesco Redi did meat and maggots. They saw maggots forming in meat, raw stinking meat. And they thought, wow, life spontaneously generated from the meat. And he went in and he experimented several different times because they kept not believing him. But no, we all know today maggots are not born in meat. It would be flies coming to lay their eggs in the meat, and then the maggots would be formed. All life is from life, and that makes a big problem, because at some point, for evolutionists, there had to be non-life and there had to be life, even though all life is from life. And we saw the Miller-Urey experiment in that last video where they tried to spontaneously generate life by running lightning through it. He had water, methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, which is great, except you're missing something that all of life needs. It's oxygen. And oxygen kills off any of the proteins that are trying to be formed inside of there, so it didn't work. Several other major problems with the theory, and this will tie into something that we're probably going to end up talking about next week, but the sun is losing 5 million tons of mass per second. Now you think about that. 5 million tons of mass every second is being lost by the sun. There's this principle that evolutionists love is the principle of uniformity, that everything that as it is now is how it's always been. Well, if we apply that to this idea, then the sun losing 5 million tons of mass per second, if you go back enough seconds, the sun was a lot bigger than it is right now. And if the world is 6,000 years old, it's not really a problem. But if you go back 14 billion years, then the sun is quite a bit bigger than it is right now, and it would be too hot for life to originate on Earth. The Earth is spinning, its spin is slowing down at about 1/1,000th of a second per day. What does that suggest? If everything is like it always has been, it was spinning faster before, right? So if we go back 6,000 years, that's not really a problem. If we go back 14 billion years, the Earth was spinning so fast that nothing would stay on it in the first place, okay? The distance to the moon is increasing each revolution. The moon is getting further and further away every time it goes around. What does that tell us? That it used to be closer. In fact, if we went back 14 billion years, the moon is rolling on the Earth of the surface. I mean, we're major problems here. And we started out with this, and I want to end with this. All ideas have consequences, and that's what I want to get to. Your idea, no matter what it is, where it came from, who had it, who gave it to you, it has consequences. And the ideas of evolution have some really terrible consequences. Charles Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, but The actual title was On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. And there was somebody who picked up on this idea and wanted to implement the whole idea of preserving favored races. There were several people, actually. Charles Darwin wrote in his book, The Descent of Man, he said, with savages, the weak in body or mind are soon eliminated. Savages meaning third world people. When you look at people just in the wild, doing whatever, you'll kill off the weak ones. Those that survive commonly exhibit a vigorous state of health. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination, don't we? We try to protect the weak ones. We try to support the people that don't know what they're doing. We have love for people around us. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, and the sick. We institute poor laws, and our medical men exert their utmost skill to save the life of everyone to the last moment. Yes, we do. The problem is what he's saying is that that doesn't line up with what evolution states. Because of that, the weak members of civilized society propagate their kind. They reproduce. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of men. Hardly anyone would be so ignorant as to allow their worst animals to breed. If we are all animals, then we should make sure that those people don't breed. We should really control the flow of how this works. Let's get rid of these people. Let's keep these people. You guys are good. You guys are not good. We're going to preserve favored races here. It's the implementation of evolution. It's had political effects. The names of these people up here were staunch supporters of this. And they had hierarchies for who was favored races and who was not. Peter Singer rewrote the five traditional commandments that we see here. Treat all human life as of equal worth. Never intentionally take innocent human life. Never take your own life and always try to prevent others from taking theirs. Be fruitful and multiply. Treat all human life as more precious than non-human life. These are things that we could all agree with, yes? He took them and he rewrote them. He said, if you believe in evolution, you need to recognize that the worth of human life varies. Not everybody is important. You have to take responsibility for the consequences of your decisions, but allowing or helping others to die may be appropriate. Respect a person's desire to live or die. You just respect that. Bringing children into the world only if you want them. And don't discriminate on the basis of species, meaning human life and non-human life, they're kind of a mix. And these sound ridiculous when you read them and we're sitting here thinking about it, but they're not ridiculous to people who believe that everybody's an animal. Why don't you take a look at this video?
You believe in evolution?
Yes, I do.
You have a dog?
Yes.
Love your dog?
I do love my dog.
Yes, I do. I love animals.
Okay. Well, your pet dog and your rotten neighbor are drowning. You'd only save one of them. Who would you save?
That is a tough one.
You only save one?
Why are you hesitating?
I think I would save my dog.
I don't know why I'm really hesitating. Because, I don't know, I feel like people would see me as a bad person if I said the dog.
I'll save my dog.
So, is your neighbor not worth saving?
Well, he's not worth saving more than my dog is.
I'd go with the dog.
Yeah. I mean, you would want to save the animals. So I would want to save my dog.
Well, we're animals. I believe we're all equal. I don't think humans have, like, a higher, like, place.
So you think dogs are more valuable than human beings? Do you believe in evolution?
Yes, I do.
It's just a matter of survival of the fittest. Your neighbor's a primate, and you've got a canine, and you like the canine more than you like the primate. Would that be right?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's survival of the fittest. I mean,
survival of the fittest?
Yeah, pretty much.
We can't wonder, and I know we don't in here, but people everywhere are wondering why society is crazy and why people are idiots and why people are acting the way they are. It's because you're telling them they're animals. And that's all that you can come up with when you're an animal, is that if everybody's an animal, then I'll go with the animal that I like. I have a relationship with my dog, so I'm going to save my dog. evolution says survival of the fittest. These are the consequences of its idea. And if you take that and play that out, that means that there are no expectations for your life. And if there are no expectations for your life, then only the strong can survive, and it doesn't matter what you do, your expectations, their expectations, none of it matters. So why should I obey the cops? Why should I help society? Why should I raise my kids? Why should I be a good son or daughter? There's no expectations, and only the strong survive. And if only the strong survive, that means by implication that the weak should die out. There's no reason for them to continue living. And we see this. Babies with defects should be aborted. Now, you know that that one might have these, this, this, and this problem, so let's just go ahead and get rid of that before you have to deal with that for the rest of your life. Well, that works fine if you ascribe to the idea that everything's just an animal and there is no expectation. But if all life is precious to God, then no, we're going to do everything we can to save everyone we can. Babies with defects should be aborted is what evolutionists believe, and the old probably should die out too. We didn't get into this, but eugenics, it just, there is no importance placed on humanity whatsoever. You can live with accountability, and you can live knowing that no matter what you do, it won't have any real significance in life. That is the conclusion that all of these kids at these colleges are arriving at. Young people seeing it everywhere. There's no reason. There's no point. Why do anything that matters? You should just stare at a computer screen all day long. If it makes you happy, do it. Because there's no accountability. Nobody's going to ask you why you did that. And if they ask you, they don't have a right to ask you. They don't have a right to judge you. You don't have to. Those are the consequences of the ideas of evolution. Here's the deal, though. If there are so many problems with the theory of evolution, why do they hold to it so tightly? There are a lot of holes, and if you can ever get to talk to one of them on a one-on-one level, they will admit to you that there are a lot of problems with their theory. They won't in public, and that's why I never get into conversation with people in a public forum, but when you're in public and in front of other people, your defenses and your guard is up, and you're gonna say things that you don't even know what you're saying. But why are they holding to it so tightly? The truth is that I really don't believe there are a lot of diehard evolutionists. I believe there are a lot of scared atheists clinging to the only idea that keeps God out of the picture. The only idea that keeps God out of the picture. Because the truth is, evolution is a necessity for atheism. Now, here's the deal. Atheism has gotten a really big, it's a big cultural word, and there are a lot of people who still cling to it, but there are a lot of people who are at least intellectually honest enough to not say that they're an evolutionist. An atheist, sorry. They ascribe to something else that is tied to this right here. Intelligent design. How many have heard of intelligent design? Now, intelligent design is a word that has come up, and it does not mean the same thing as creationism, okay? It's a halfway point between the two. Intelligent design says that life was designed. You have scientists that will agree and see, well, obviously, that was designed. It has some sort of purpose, obviously, if there is a design. But someone or something designed everything, but it might have been God, or it could have been gods, or it could have been aliens. It's I don't know. Does that make sense? I'm not kidding about the aliens thing. They have an idea called directed panspermia. And that idea is exactly what it sounds like. Intelligent design, I believe, is a platform for agnostics. It is acknowledging one fact while still denying the other. Agnosticism is saying it's the great belief of I don't know. Atheists, I don't know how they hold on to it. We're all going to get together and decide not to believe into something. That's our idea. But this one is much more dangerous because this one plays right into today's culture. How much and how often do you see and hear, basically, I don't care. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't bother me. I won't mess with that. I don't know. I'm doing my thing. Agnosticism is actually where Charles Darwin found himself. He said, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. I think that generally, and more as I grow older, but not always, that agnostic would be the most correct description of my state of mind. I don't know. It's really hard to live on I don't know. It's really frustrating to live on I don't know. Because if I don't know and I don't care, and that probably means that other people don't know and they don't care, and if nobody cares, then why am I here? And it still goes down the same pitfalls.
Was this later in life?
That was in... I'd have to look into when he wrote that. It was in a letter written to Asa Gray, and I don't remember the time or date of when that was. Creation states that your decisions matter. These are the consequences of believing in creation, and this is why people don't. If your decision matters, then you can make a wrong decision. You can. There are bad things. Your attitude does matter. That's the worst thing that you can tell anybody, because nobody wants to check their attitude. What you do with your life matters. You have a purpose. You will be held accountable for every word that comes out of your mouth. You will have to answer for every action that you do. That creates some tension in some people. But here's the truth. Creation is the only foundation that Christianity can stand on. It's the only one. This is just an introduction, and I went long again. This is just an overview introduction, half of one. And I've got much more to come. We'll at least be doing one more week of things. But I hope you've got a better understanding of evolution and creation and the things that go along with it. If you want some more ideas, this is a great book here. I don't know, has anybody read that book before, Case for Creator? Same guy that wrote Case for Christ. He was a journalist that set off to debunk evolution and ended up finding evidence that it didn't actually work out. Another good Answers in Genesis, Answers books. They've got lots of good answers to questions. A couple of other books. If you have any questions about resources or thoughts or ideas, you want to ask me anything, has anybody had any ideas of questions that they'd like us to discuss in this? Nope. If you have any, you can come up to me afterwards. That's all I have for you today. We'll pick it up again next week. You guys have a good day.
We hope that you have been blessed, encouraged, and motivated by today's message. If you are interested in more messages by Christian Ministries Church, then log on to our website at www.cmchurch.net and click on the podcast link.